Hello there. Today is Thursday, July 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump creates a new controversy regarding transgender people serving in the military.
The decision is based on a military decision. It's not meant to be anything more than that.
The president also continues his attacks on his attorney general. Concerns over rising tensions regarding a Jerusalem holy site. Also ahead, a unique college graduation where students couldn't hear a thing. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump said Wednesday the U.S. military will no longer let transgender people serve in any capacity, reversing a policy former President Barack Obama's administration announced a year ago. In a string of Twitter comments, Trump said that after consulting with generals and military experts, he was ordering the armed forces to stop accepting transgender recruits. The decision was not without criticism from members of both parties, including prominent Republicans such as Lindsey Graham, the senator, who said that a tweet is not the right way to make this sort of announcement.
I don't know what the policy proposal is. I don't know why he decided what he did, but I think the right way to do this is have a hearing so you can hear from both sides, have the Secretary of Defense and generals come before the committee to explain what their recommendations are, make a reasoned decision about those who are serving as transgender, what happens to them. At the end of the day, I want a strong, vibrant military, but I want to be fair. And the best way to do this is have a hearing, not a tweet.
Well, during Wednesday's daily briefing, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders rebuffed a reporter's question suggesting the decision is a broken campaign promise when candidate Trump said he would protect transgender rights and be better on the issue than his then opponent, Hillary Clinton.
The president has a lot of support for all Americans and certainly wants to protect all Americans at all times. The president's expressed concern since this Obama policy came into effect. But he's also voiced that this is a very expensive and disruptive policy, and based on consultation that he's had with his national security team, came to the conclusion that it erodes military readiness and unit cohesion.
When the Obama administration made the decision to allow transgender personnel to serve openly just a year ago, it did it in part relying on a study by the nonprofit research institution RAND Corporation, which looked at the impact of transgender personnel on readiness and health care costs in the U.S. military. Joining me now is the co-author of that study, RAND senior economist Radha Iyengar.
So we looked at what the potential readiness and medical costs were for allowing transgender people to serve openly in the U.S. military. And our big takeaway is really that the numbers here are just really small. So the number of transgender personnel serving is only a fraction of a percent of the total force, either for the active component or the reserve component. That of those folks, so a couple thousand, anywhere from 1,300 to 6,600 in the active component out of 1.3 million, only a small fraction of those are going to seek transgender medical services. So that means that you're looking at less than 1% of the workforce seeking any medical treatment that might affect their readiness, and the total medical costs for that are really less than about a tenth of a percent of the total medical cost for DOD. So the numbers are small.
Do you know if the military actually took any of that information that you researched into consideration originally during the Obama administration when they made the decision?
Sure did. So Secretary Carter, who made the decision at the time, actually cited the study in his decision. And we did a lot of briefing of his studies to senior military officials to make sure that they were aware of the study and its findings.
Do you have any idea why the Trump administration would say that it is too costly after a completely different conclusion was found just a year ago?
I don't have any way to speculate on what might have motivated the president's tweets. What I can say is we took really a broad look at all of the evidence that was out there, all of the different estimates on prevalence of transgender personnel, healthcare costs both in the private sector from actual utilization rates and from the Veterans Administration. We did a comprehensive look at the evidence out there, and the evidence suggests that the total costs are just very small. The exact word we use in the report is negligible.
My understanding is there are an estimated 15,000 transgender military service members. A little over half are active duty, and that's a large portion of the general population. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah, so we actually looked at a number of the different prevalence estimates, as they're called. So that 15,000 number comes from looking at active duty, reserve component, and then a range of other sort of associated to the military personnel. It's probably an upper bound based on what we know. And that's really talking about individuals who identify as transgender. So our estimates, sort of narrowing that down to just the active component and select reserve, suggest somewhere between 3 and 10,000 active duty personnel based on the 2014 force size. So it would be a little bit bigger than that now because the force has grown since then. But again, remember that 15,000, even if you took that number, that's not the set of people who are going to seek medical treatments and sort of impose costs from not being able to be deployed. So I think it's important to remember that only a small fraction of those are going to seek medical care, like mental health care or hormone replacement therapy, and only a small fraction of those are going to go on to seek gender reassignment or gender transitioning surgeries. Our estimates suggest about somewhere between 10 to 130 active duty personnel per year are likely to seek gender transition surgery treatments.
Now, is that something that the military would be obliged to pay for if they did choose to do so?
So that is sort of under debate in the existing policy discussion. I don't know how they will end up in that decision, but our estimates suggest that the cost of covering that is relatively low just because of the small numbers of people.
What went into the study in particular as far as how many people worked on it, how many, you know, yep. How much time?
So we had a team of people, I think maybe 7 or 8, they're listed on the study, and I don't have that total number in front of me. But in addition, RAND has a quality assurance process. That means we actually do have peer reviewers who review the study for its quality and data availability. And then based on that, they provide sort of, you know, oversight and management to make sure that happens. In addition, at RAND, we make sure everything is publicly available. So all of the numbers, all of the tables, all of the analysis we've done is detailed in that report and can be replicated and used again for other people to assess, you know, make their own judgments. And that's a little bit why I'm talking about all of these different prevalence numbers and percentages, because at the end of the day, there were a wide range of different numbers that could be used to estimate the total number of transgender personnel. Even at those upper bound estimates, the total numbers, the total effects, the total costs were all really small. I should say that another part of what we did was look at the experience of other countries who allowed open service for transgender personnel, including the United Kingdom, Australia, Israel, and Canada. So countries that have similar force structures and operational requirements to the U.S. And we also found in those cases that there was no evidence of any effects on unit cohesion or operational effectiveness. So put another way, other countries with similar forces to ours also didn't see any impacts to their readiness.
All right, that's RAND senior economist Radha Iyengar. President Trump didn't say what would happen to transgender people already serving in the military. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. More healthcare headaches for U.S. Senate Republicans. Burundian teens' parents say they're not worried about their disappearance in the U.S. Angelina Jolie reveals she has Bell's palsy. And from a humble start, a NASA engineer uplifts herself and others. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Hundreds of Palestinians have been dancing, cheering, and celebrating in the streets after Israel removed railings and an overhead metal bridge it recently installed near a contested Jerusalem holy site at the demand of Muslim protesters. Israel had initially added the security measures after a July 14th shooting attack from the shrine by Arab gunmen that killed two Israeli policemen. Metal detectors were removed Tuesday, but Muslims staged major prayer protests to press for the removal of the other devices as well. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Dr. Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque has been a flashpoint of confrontation between Israeli occupation forces and the Palestinian population in East Jerusalem. And while the security measures put in place by Israel would not seem in and of themselves unreasonable, given the violence and terrorism that has plagued that city, the symbolism of Al-Aqsa Mosque being the third holiest site in Islam, and the feelings of after 50 years of occupation and seeing so much else taken away from them, it certainly has led quite a few Palestinians to protest and mobilize on what they see as the latest affront by Israeli occupation forces. The Netanyahu government at this point may be thinking that the risk of terrorism and of violence, rather than being curbed by these security measures, may actually be worsened by the popular reaction to these security measures, decided to remove these security measures.
So is Israel backing down?
It appears that Israel is backing down on this particular point of contention, but there are many other areas, obviously, of contention in the Old City and in other parts of occupied East Jerusalem. Just in the past hour, it appears that Prime Minister Netanyahu will be expelling journalists from Al Jazeera, from Israel and the occupied territories, somehow blaming them as being responsible for the latest violence. And of course, the reverberations from the attack on the three Israeli soldiers and the killings of Palestinian civilians and subsequent protests are certainly going to continue for some time to come.
Rival Palestinian factions Fatah and Hamas have issued calls for mass protests by Muslims against Israel on Friday over those security measures. The separate statements Wednesday, Fatah called for a day of rage all over Palestine. Gaza's Hamas rulers said the demonstration should be in the West Bank. Obviously, this is a situation that could get out of hand.
Very much so. There's obviously a lot of passion when it comes to holy sites. We have seen violence and extremism, from both hardline Jewish and Muslim elements. Indeed, back in 1969, a Christian fundamentalist tried to burn down the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So there is certainly the risk that this could indeed get out of hand. But ultimately, even though the security measures at the Al-Aqsa Mosque is what has brought many of these frustrations to the fore, it ultimately comes down to the 50 years of Israeli occupation of the East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and the failure for the sides to come together for a peaceful resolution to the conflict.
That's Dr. Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. Well, the chief law enforcement officer of the United States is in a perilous position, undermined in recent days by President Trump, who appointed him as attorney general. Jeff Sessions finds himself now under pressure to resign. White House correspondent Steve Herman reports.
Donald Trump for the presidency of the United
Jeff Sessions, as an influential conservative Republican senator, was an early and strong supporter of Donald Trump's long-shot presidential campaign. But Trump in recent days has chastised Sessions for recusing himself from the Russia investigation, calling him beleaguered and weak.
It's clear that President Trump's trying to bully his own attorney general out of office.
Some Republican lawmakers are speaking in support of their former colleague.
Jeff has been very loyal to the president, and I think he deserves loyalty back.
Sessions, as do all cabinet appointees, serve at the pleasure of the president.
It's up to the president to decide what his personnel decisions is and any possible fallout that comes from that.
Trump denied Tuesday he is leaving Sessions twisting in the wind, but he made no move to throw his attorney general a lifeline.
I'm very disappointed with the attorney general. But we will see what happens. Time will tell. Time will tell.
The president could find himself paying a high political price among conservatives for abandoning a stalwart such as Sessions.
A lot of them are wondering how long can they continue to balance their relationship with the president, along with the need to accomplish these policies that they want to achieve, given that the White House and both houses of Congress are controlled by Republicans.
Donald Trump formulating his candidacy adopted many of Sessions' policies, such as on immigration, using them to gain support among America's disenchanted conservative base and helping him to end up here. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
New sanctions punishing Russia for its interference in last year's U.S. presidential election cleared a key step Tuesday as the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill expanding congressional checks on President Trump's ability to ease those penalties. VOA's Catherine Gibson has more from the Capitol.
Russia, Iran, and North Korea receiving a strong message from the U.S. Congress.
These three regimes in different parts of the world are threatening vital U.S. interests, and they are destabilizing their neighbors.
And while the bill would impose tough economic and diplomatic penalties, it also sends a message to President Trump. New congressional oversight powers a needed check, said the top Democrat on House Foreign Affairs.
If President Trump wants to play golf or do something with his crony, Mr. Putin, he can count the Congress out because we're going to punish Mr. Putin.
Amid congressional investigations into alleged links between the Trump campaign and Russia, an unusually bipartisan move by lawmakers to limit executive powers to lift sanctions.
This is a significant restraint on President Trump because no president wants to lose the leverage of being able to take off sanctions.
A restraint the White House initially lobbied against before coming out in support of the sanctions earlier this week.
The administration is supportive of being tough on Russia, particularly in putting these sanctions in place.
The cost of congressional oversight, the possible loss of U.S. diplomatic flexibility, says a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
Sanctions, once they're embedded in law, may actually prove less successful in eliciting a change in Russian behavior than when they're based on executive orders.
A loss that sets up a tough choice for President Trump.
A veto would come at a price. First of all, it would be seen as one more piece, suggesting that, in fact, something improper was worked out between the Trump campaign and the Russians back during the election in 2016. And second, there's a strong likelihood that that veto would be overridden.
And with just days to go until August recess, lawmakers are racing to finish that legislation to secure the president's signature. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
So a couple fun stories today about social media. The first one looks at what we write on social media. And I think that there's a general assumption that what we put on social media tends to not be the most polished of discourse. We use a lot of abbreviations. We use a lot of emojis, that kind of thing. But there's a study out from the National Research University Higher School of Economics in Moscow, Russia, where a researcher there looked at social media posts over about an 8-year period, over a million people posting online in that 8-year period that he looked at. And this researcher found that, surprisingly, the level of length of words and complexity of words over that time period actually went up.
Interesting.
You would expect social media, you know, everything gets put in shorthand.
Yes.
he found that from 2008 to 2016, the word length increased, and it increased across all age levels. So it's not just that people are necessarily getting older and using more complex words. Even teenagers in 2016 were using more complex words and longer words than they were in 2008.
Any explanation why?
No, in a word, no. They, they're not sure why exactly this is. Maybe more people becoming educated. There is something called the Flynn effect that has been written about, which is the general theory that people over time get smarter, that IQs increase just because people have more access to education and technology and all these things that tend to make us smarter. So that's the assumption here. It's something like that. In fact, the paper that he wrote was called The Digital Flynn Effect, about this study about the word length. So that's what they're assuming right now, that it's kind of just the general evolution of social media. And the more people use it, the more they write, the more the word counts go up. So that's the theory that they're operating under. But I'm sure this is just the first of many studies that we're going to see about this. Now that they've peeled back the cover on this, I think there's going to be a lot of research into what we write on social media and if it is indeed getting more complex.
Cool. Well, it's a fascinating study. Anything else?
Yeah, something fascinating in a different way, particularly for those of us who enjoy shopping online. And really, who doesn't enjoy shopping online, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And for a lot of times when people shop online, here's what happens. They go online, they see, you know, a great shirt or a pair of pants or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, I want that.
Right.
But they can't find it because it's a picture on a website or from wherever, on a blog. Well, eBay, the online marketplace retailer, is trying to change that. And starting this fall, they're going to roll out two new things. They're going to have an image search, which will allow you to upload a photo and search through eBay's database of everything that's being sold and try to find the item in the photo. So if you see a shirt you like, you just save that image, upload it, and eBay will let you know if that shirt is available for sale. The other thing is called Find It on eBay, and that'll allow you to do kind of the same thing, except with any kind of URL from a blog or Pinterest, anywhere like that, social media. You just put that URL in, and mm-hmm. it'll look up whatever is pictured on that URL and try to find it on eBay.
Hmm.
So this is pretty interesting stuff. It's similar to what other services have done, including Google Images in the past, where you can upload an image and they will try to find matching images on the internet. So it's similar to that, but this is maybe the first time it's been used for commerce. So I think a lot of people are going to be very happy to do some nice shopping and find some things that they thought they could never find before online.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. describes itself as no other place like this in the world. The 153-year-old institution is unique, educating the deaf around the world. From around the world, VOA's Yahya Albarzinji covered graduation day at Gallaudet. Here's Steve Reddish with his report on the learning environment in the school.
It's graduation day at Gallaudet University. Students might not hear the trumpets, but they can feel the vibrations of the drums. The ceremony culminates years of hard work.
I'm here today because my son is graduating from Gallaudet. Yay! And it's been a long road, but he made it and he was successful, so we're here to celebrate him.
Like any language, sign language differs from country to country. Because there is no universal sign language, when Iranian student Ardavan Giti speaks, his friends back home do not understand him because he uses American Sign Language.
Each country has its own unique sign language and culture that are unique to that country. And there are even accents in sign language and within a single country. When I came here to the States, I learned American Sign Language, but my native sign language is ZEI, which is the Iranian Sign Language.
Gallaudet University is the world's only liberal arts college for the deaf. More than 150 years old, Gallaudet offers deaf students a bilingual education in English and American Sign Language. At the graduation ceremony, the hall is quiet except for the music of the performers because all that needs to be said is said in silence. Even joy and congratulations are expressed in an excited state of silence. One graduated student wants to bring her college experience back to her native Egypt.
We can learn from Gallaudet's example and America's example, specifically looking at what do deaf children need, right? So that we can add those into our systems and other areas.
Graduation also means entering the job market, which can bring more challenges than normal for the deaf.
But deaf people are very often working twice as hard to show that they can do the work that others do. And I think if you compare the U.S. to other countries, well, certainly, you know, other countries have far less recognition of deaf people's ability.
We have proof that deaf people can do anything and everything they set their minds to at very high levels of achievement. We can do anything.
After studying and earning their degrees in relative silence, hundreds of Gallaudet graduates are now ready to make a statement in the world's workplace. For reporter Yahya Alberzinji, I'm Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition on VOA. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States applauds the Council on the European Union's recent decision to sanction 16 Syrian military officials and scientists for their roles in the development and use of chemical weapons on civilian populations on behalf of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The sanctions on 8 members of the Scientific Studies and Research Center, as well as 8 high-ranking officials, follow upon similar actions by the U.S. and other allies aimed at holding the Assad government accountable for violating the United Nations Chemical Weapons Convention by gassing its own people. Such attacks include one on the town of Khan Shaykhun in Idlib province last April. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has determined that sarin gas was used in the attack, which killed at least 82 civilians, including children. U.S. and other Western intelligence reports say the Assad regime was responsible. According to the United Nations, there were also 3 incidents in 2016 where chlorine gas was used on civilians. The sanctions will freeze the financial assets of the 16 Syrians and restrict their ability to travel. The United States is committed to reducing civilian suffering in Syria and recently agreed with Russia and Jordan to support a ceasefire and the delivery of humanitarian assistance in the southwest region. Russia has backed the Assad regime in the conflict. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called the agreement the first indication the U.S. and Russia can work together in Syria, and it noted hopes that the progress can be replicated with further ceasefires throughout the country. Russia, said Secretary Tillerson, has the same, I think, interest that we do in having Syria become a stable place, a unified place, but ultimately a place where we can facilitate a political discussion about the future, including the future leadership of Syria. He made clear, however, that the Assad regime has lost credibility with the international community. We think it will be difficult, he said, for them to attract both the humanitarian aid as well as the reconstruction assistance that's going to be required because there just will be such a low level of confidence in the Assad government. How Assad leaves is yet to be determined, said Secretary Tillerson, but our view is that somewhere in that political process, there will be a transition away from the Assad family.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.